I next met with Dr. Vincent Rajkumar to get an update on multiple myeloma, and to begin, he commented on his changing perspective on optimal upfront induction treatment.
Until ASH of last year, people in the U.S. could use a wide variety of regimens to treat a newly diagnosed patient's Lendex, bortezomib, Cyclodex, or Cybord, VRD, as well as other regimens like VTD. But at ASH last year, we heard the SWOG phase 3 trial that showed that VRD had not only better response rates and PFS, but also significantly better overall survival compared to Lendex. So that is the best data we have. And using that, we have now, all of us have switched to VRD as the standard frontline treatment for elderly as well as for patients who are eligible for transplant. Now, high-risk patients, I think VRD would still be a great choice. But some of us are starting to think maybe in the high-risk patients, we could experiment and use carfilzomib Lendex instead. But that's much more of a softer recommendation. So there's a great uniformity in if you're going to use a triplet, then VRD is the de facto standard. There are some elderly patients for whom VRD may be difficult to give because they have very high comorbidities and they have poor performance status, in which case Lendex is still a reasonable alternative. But if you do Lendex, you have to give it until progression.
So it's interesting you bring up the KRD, and of course there's a randomized trial out there attempting to answer that question. But putting aside sort of cost, regulatory issues, et cetera, right now, if you could just choose what you think is best for your patient, both normal risk or standard risk, as well as your patient, would you choose to use KRD?
I'd choose to use KRD in the high-risk patients. I'm very reluctant to recommend it in the standard risk patients because there are risks to consider. KRD has not been compared head-to-head with VRD in a randomized trial. That trial is still ongoing. But in non-randomized comparisons, KRD seems to have better rates of CR and MRD negative. At the same time, it also has more toxicity and some concerns about cardiac side effects. And so we are reluctant to recommend it to a standard risk population, which has traditionally done extraordinarily well on VRD, both in the SWOG trial and the IFM trial. And so I'm reserving the more risky option of KRD for the high-risk patients for whom that kind of risk is worth taking.
You mentioned the issue of the induction regimen, but the other question out there that's been out there for a long time is the question of transplant. And again, we saw some data at ASH reflecting there's been this question, is the old data on transplant is relevant now with newer agents? What do we see at ASH, and how is that affected, and how other data sets affected the way you look at the question of transplant?
Another excellent point. Besides the big SWOG trial, the other big news at ASH was the IFM trial that compared VRD followed by either continuing with VRD or doing an early transplant. And what they showed that even with all these new drugs, you gain about 9 months in terms of progression-free survival with the use of early transplant. The other thing we found out is regardless of which approach you choose, early or delayed transplant, the outcome was excellent. At 4 years, 82% of patients were alive, which is outstanding for newly diagnosed myeloma. It was not like that even a few years ago. So with modern therapy, we learned that early transplant gives you better PFS and the overall survival may be too early to interpret, but looks outstanding for both arms. And that, you know, we still need to incorporate transplant in the treatment strategy. Now, one point, if I may make, is that for the high risk and intermediate risk patients, we still would prefer the early transplant. But even with the IFM results, I think for standard risk patients, one could make the case that if a patient really wanted to delay transplant, you could use the same trial to say that, hey, they're going to do survival-wise identical, and that for standard risk patients, if they really wanted to delay it, that's still reasonable.
I guess the other point is, as you mentioned, the data that was presented was sort of the French side, the IFM side. There's also a North American study, and I've heard people say that they want to wait before making a conclusion to see the North American data, not just because of North America, because they used indefinite maintenance and they thought maybe the control arm might do better. Any thoughts about that?
I think it could very well do, because the French trial, if you look at it at the end of the day, the difference between the two arms was really comparing an auto transplant to 3 extra cycles of the RVD. Now, that may not be enough. The 3 extra cycles of RVD may not be enough to overcome the PFS advantage that a full-blown auto transplant gives. On the other hand, if you add prolonged maintenance, that may neutralize the advantage in PFS that the early transplant gave. So I think it's reasonable from that standpoint to wait for the North American study. Also, the North American and the French studies can be indirectly compared in, albeit in a non-randomized manner, to compare the benefit of a one-year maintenance len versus an indefinite maintenance len strategy.
So another issue that, as I saw those data, I'm not sure if my conclusion and you would agree with it, it looked like the people in the non-transplant arm who achieved MRD negativity just with the VRD did really well. Could you envisioning looking at MRD before deciding whether to do a transplant?
Yeah, I think that's going to happen because a lot of people are wondering if the real endpoint is the MRD negative state, whichever way you achieve it. And granted, you have a greater chance of achieving MRD negative with transplant, but if you happen to achieve MRD negative with just VRD, then maybe we can delay the transplant and still get the same PFS benefit. So I think there's going to be a lot of interest in how to interpret these trials. The other point to make is that the MRD definitions are going to be standardized so that a paper will come out very soon in the Lancet Oncology describing the International Myeloma Working Group criteria for what is MRD negative by flow and by sequencing. And so as the standardizations occur, we may be able to use a biomarker like MRD to determine, you know, sequence of therapy.
Do you think that it's possible or likely we're going to enter into sort of a CML type platform where we're just going to be guiding therapy based on MRD levels?
I'd like that because it'll provide value. Because if we say indefinite therapy for all myeloma patients for the rest of their lives, I think it's not good from a cost standpoint or from a convenience or side effect or quality of life standpoint. On the other hand, if we say that, hey, we're going to give prolonged therapy for a few years, but then after that, we bring the value by showing that by reaching a particular disease negative state that we could stop therapy and get the same benefit. Trials have to be done and designed in such a manner that we can test that. And many groups are planning trials like that. And I'm really optimistic that we can enter a mode where MRD negative state can be used to stop therapy.
So one of my favorite, you know, we always like to ask poll questions whenever we're out, you know, doing programs. One of my favorite recent ones has been, you have a patient with myeloma, 17p deletion, they go through a VRD and transplant. You want to put them on bortezomib maintenance and they go, well, you know, it takes me 2 hours to get to the clinic. Can you give me exazimib? How do you respond?
You know, if it's truly very difficult logistically for the patient to get bortezomib, then I think I'm okay with exazimib, but with just a couple of caveats. One is that there is a huge cost issue that if not today, next year, bortezomib, when it goes generic, will be much less expensive. It is a more tried and tested drug than exazimib. On the other hand, exazimib offers the convenience of oral therapy and the convenience of once weekly, you know, just 3 extra pills a month. The reason I'm hesitant again is that we do have a phase 3 randomized trial that is comparing exazimib to placebo for maintenance. The results should be coming anytime soon, and I'd rather wait for the results, but if there are exceptions, like, you know, where the patient's truly not able to, and it's a question of not getting maintenance at all, then yes, we should certainly promote the use of exazimib in that setting.
You know, one of the issues, we actually had a patient presented at one of our symposia recently. Actually, this patient had gotten a whole bunch of other therapies and then got transplanted. And I wanted to ask you how you approach maintenance in that situation. They may have already had bortezomib, lenalidomide, et cetera, and then they change their mind, they get a delayed transplant. In any event, this patient ended up getting exazimib maintenance and actually had a fair amount of difficulty with GI toxicity. And I was curious what your experience is and, you know, what the issues are with trying to maintain somebody for multiple years on this drug.
You know, exazimib does have a dose-related GI side effect profile. So at 4 milligrams, most people tolerate it very well. 5 and 5.5, there's GI issues. As you go lower on the dose, it is tolerated well. At the same time, I'm worried, like, do we lose efficacy? For example, in the most recent trial publication in the New England Journal of Medicine comparing exazimib, Lendex to Lendex, the grade 3 side effect profile is almost identical. So it means like the drug's very safe. At the same time, did we sacrifice some efficacy because the second interim analysis of that trial, the PFS advantage shrunk? And that was the reason the Europeans refused to approve the drug now. So, you know, you have to be careful that, yes, we can lower the dose quite easily, but then did we lose substantial efficacy?
And I did want to ask you about this question about how you handle post-transplant maintenance and the patient's already had multiple therapies. Is it just sort of all bets are off, go with what, you know, they haven't had recently? Or how do you think through that issue? Do you sometimes not use maintenance?
Oh, it's very difficult. I mean, just after ASCO, when the meta-analysis showed us a survival benefit, when you pool the three randomized trials with maintenance lenalidomide, our group feels that we should offer routine maintenance. So when the philosophy is like offering maintenance will save lives or prolong survival, then you have to really, you know, scratch your head. How do you approach a patient who's already refractory to the usual maintenance treatments? Like they are either intolerant or refractory to bortezomib or lenalidomide. I do then say, like, you know, we should somehow find a way to deliver maintenance and look to other drugs. The best options would be, if I can get away with it, will be daratumumab. You know, maintenance, it's a once monthly daratumumab would be an ideal maintenance drug. We don't have data on that. I would search for carfilzomib, like at a once weekly dose, which has been piloted. Maybe once weekly carfilzomib for the high risk patients if they have a problem tolerating bortezomib or are refractory to bortezomib. And then, of course, pomalidomide instead of lenalidomide if there is an issue with lenalidomide. And yes, these are not FDA-approved strategies, but if the patient is better off on maintenance and they are somehow not able to take len or bortezomib for some reason, I do try to reach deep into the arsenal of other options we have.
Yeah, I was thinking, actually, this case that made me think, too, about daratumumab. I think, actually, the case this occurred right before daratumumab was approved. The other thing I was wondering about, I know this is being studied in a trial setting, but could you ever justify, again, in patients, say, who had prior lenalidomide, len-elotuzumab maintenance?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the ELO-LEN trial or the DARA-LEN trials, you know, I'm talking about ELOQUENT trial and the POLLUX trial. What's apparent is you can prolong the LEN effect quite substantially by adding one of these two monoclonal antibodies. With ELOQUENT, there is a survival advantage already shown. With POLLUX, there's an incredible PFS advantage that has been shown. So yes, I think if you have a patient where you're worried about how LEN alone might do, there is a role for adding these two antibodies. The concerns would be the lack of data in the maintenance setting and the cost that is added in the maintenance setting, because both, you know, len alone is expensive, and then when you add another drug, it really blows the cost up the roof.
A couple more questions. One, you mentioned the data presented at ASH on once weekly carfilzomib. Was that enough to actually do that in your practice?
Not yet. We are still sticking with the usual 27 milligrams per meter squared, you know, day one, day two type regimen. I am waiting for more data. There are issues with the 70 milligrams per meter squared in terms of, like, you know, side effects that I have to wrestle with before I endorse that. Having said that, there's also the Endeavor study, which shows that you could administer twice the dose of carfilzomib and get better results. So there's a lot more that we can do with carfilzomib. I think it is a great drug in terms of, even at the 27 milligram per meter squared dose, it works in patients who have failed bortezomib. At the 56, I'm pretty sure it'll work even more. And at 70 once a week, it becomes a much more convenient option. Just waiting for a little bit more data to start using these in practice.
So let's go on and talk about the scenario of the 72-year-old patient you put together. And we can get more into probably the number one question I hear from oncologists is, what do we do with these two monoclonal antibodies? So let's hear about the 72-year-old patient.
Okay, this is a great case because it illustrates what a normal practice might be now. I mean, the patient is 72 presenting with relapsed myeloma in 2016. What has happened in the past is that the patient was first diagnosed in 2010, got four cycles of VRD and transplant, and went 4 years on len maintenance. That's like typical. That's typical. When you give VRD followed by a transplant, you expect about a 4 year progression-free survival on len maintenance. That's classic for this patient. Then what happens in 2014 is that the patient relapses on len maintenance and started on VRD, which is reasonable because, you know, on len maintenance, you're on a low dose of lenalidomide. And when you put back the proteasome inhibitor and increase the dose, patients do respond. And he did well for a year on that.
Could I just, before you go on to that, we could backtrack to that one point, because, of course, there are a lot of questions that oncologists have. And one of the biggest ones I hear is, you know, what about the strategy in that same scenario that you just described, relapse on the fourth year of Len maintenance, just increasing the dose of Len up, as you mentioned, from the maintenance dose to the therapeutic dose and adding in elotuzumab?
Great question. You know, what we have left unanswered is, there are four trials that have looked at patients like this. First, relapse on lenalidomide. Most of these trials, that is the RD-ELO, RD-DARA, RD-ixazomib, and the RD plus carfilzomib. All of these trials, though, the vast majority of patients were not treated with lenalidomide previously. So they're relapsing, first relapse, but it's not on a lenalidomide-based regimen. 90% of them had not seen lenalidomide before. So the U.S. practice, on the other hand, is primarily a Len maintenance practice or a lenalidomide-treated patient who's relapsing. So I don't know how generalizable these four results are going to be to the U.S. practice. Many, many of us would be using drugs like pomalidomide earlier in combination with these drugs than just using the results of these trials. That's the first problem. But having said that, if the patient is relapsing on a small dose of lenalidomide, I think all of these trials still are applicable and we could use them. Then the question is, which of the four drugs do you use? I mean, not all four of them can be the best option. One of the four is better, and it's very hard to pick because there are no randomized trials comparing these triplets. And I don't know if any of them will be done in the future either. You could be a person who could say that I want to use the regimen that's given the best hazard ratio. Well, that would be daratumumab Lendex. You can say, I want to go with the most convenient regimen. That would be ixazomib Lendex. You could say, I want the one with the lowest side effect profile. That would be ELO Lendex. Or you could say that I want to be in between and have the mix of all of these traits, and that would be carfilzomib Lendex. And it's really hard when you don't have data and you have four good regimens to adjudicate which one would you actually use. I mean, I keep asking myself, if I had myeloma and I'm relapsing on Len maintenance, which one would I use? A lot of us were thinking KRD, but now after the Pollux results were presented at EHA, have switched to DRD, which will be Dara Lendex.
Can you go back through that data set?
So at the EHA meeting, Dimopoulos presented the results of the Pollux trial. The Pollux trial compared Lendex to daratumumab Lendex. It's just like the Lendex versus ELO Lendex or the Lendex versus carfilzomib Lendex.
Interesting.
And ELO Lendex versus Lendex, carfilzomib Lendex versus Lendex, and ixazomib Lendex versus Lendex all have a hazard ratio of around 0.7 or 0.75. Daratumumab Lendex versus Lendex had a hazard ratio of like 0.37 or something like that. Dramatically different. The shape of the PFS curves were also dramatically different than what we've seen with the other ones. And daratumumab is fairly well tolerated. And so if I had to choose between the four triplets and I actually had access to the drugs, then I would probably go with the Dara Lendex for my first relapse.
What about Dara alone?
Dara alone, I'm reluctant because Dara alone gives you a PFS of only like 4 months. Whereas when you mix it with Dara Lendex, in the Pollux trial, the hazard ratio is the best we have seen in myeloma for a relapse setting. And the shape of the progression-free survival curve is very impressive. You're talking like 80% of patients progression-free at 2 years.
So do you think there's a synergy between Len and Dara?
There could very well be, given the shape of this study. You know, again, some of this data is probably very fresh. People probably haven't analyzed it enough. But there is something to be said here. At ASCO, there was a plenary presentation of bortezomib dex versus daratumumab bortezomib dex, okay?
Right.
It also had a hazard ratio of 0.35 or 0.37, astounding.
That was the plenary.
But the absolute benefit was not as striking as the benefit that we saw when you compared Lendex to daralendex. So I think I'm just putting two and two together to saying there might be a synergistic effect with Dara and Len.
Hmm. Why don't we continue on with this scenario? So you have the patient then getting KRD, and it sounds like maybe the patient were treated today. If you could, you might be thinking of something different. Then got pomalidomide dex, and then at that point was started on daratumumab. Another question, what about pomalidomide dex dara?
The patient had progression on len maintenance, was treated with bortezomib Lendex, which is reasonable, gave him an extra year. After that, tried carfilzomib Lendex. That worked for a short while. And then the patient progressed again, was treated with pomalidomide and low-dose dexamethasone. Well, not surprisingly, didn't work since the patient was heavily refractory to lenalidomide at that point and to triplets. So we chose daratumumab.
Are you saying that DARA's single-agent activity is greater than an IMID like lenalidomide or a proteasome inhibitor like bortezomib?
Well, I wrote the editorial in The Lancet for daratumumab when it was published. And if you look at the corresponding populations, so I went back to the literature and looked at what was the single-agent response rate of bortezomib in a comparable population. And if you compare bortezomib, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, thalidomide, pomalidomide, the single-agent activity of DARA is better. And the population is more refractory than those drugs faced.
Are we, you know, in the long run maybe being a couple of years, looking at this being sort of R-CHOP? In other words, just going to add daratumumab in as soon as you can early on?
I think that's what we are looking at. I think between the two antibodies, DARA has, I would say, greater role in myeloma because of its single-agent activity, whereas ELO does not have a single-agent activity. And having a single-agent activity and having the type of results it has had with CASTOR trial and the POLLUX trial, I expect it to be added to triplets. The main concern with that would be cost. It's going to be extraordinarily expensive to add a fourth drug to an already expensive triplet combination.
Well, another issue, and I really was curious to ask you about this, is the infusion reactions that are seen with daratumumab. I'm curious about your experience because I've heard stories of, you know, patients sitting in the infusion room all day and still not getting the whole dose in. I've had oncologists ask the question, can they divide up the dose of daratumumab into 2 days? What have you observed? What do we know about the infusion reaction? What do you think about this idea of splitting the dose up?
So the infusion reactions, again, it's not fair to compare in a non-randomized manner, but the infusion reactions do seem to be more with DARA than with ELO. But having said that, the grade 3, like severe infusion reactions, are seen in about 50% of patients with the first dose, but drop to about 4% with the second dose. That still means oncologists are going to see this problem because 1 in 20 patients are going to get a very severe reaction with the second dose and the third dose. And so it's not uncommon to see these patients who have severe reactions beyond the first dose. I guess in those situations, we try our best to administer the full dose of DARA, whether it takes 1 day or 2 days, and I'm quite open to that. But we try and get it in.
Anything else you want to say about DARA in terms of its utilization clinically and where it might be heading, you know, in the future?
I think, you know, the reason you've not heard too much about DARA right now is because the triplet trials, the DARA-Lendex trial, is still abstract form. The other three have been, you know, published in key journals. I mean, the New England Journal of Medicine. And so it's going to take some time before the results of Dara-Lendex vis-a-vis the other three triplets sink in to the practicing oncologists. But I think when you compare all of these four triplets, Dara stands out quite favorably compared to the other three, or at least quite competitive with the other three. And then, in fact, I have worked much less with daratumumab than I have with carfilzomib or ixazomib. I was not part of the phase 3 trial, so I really don't have any conflicts in this regard. I worked more with carfilzomib and ixazomib than with DARA, but I'm just being honest about the data and what they reflect. We are probably going to go through a time point in which we try to figure out how do you pick one of these. My answer is, I don't think you can go wrong. Patients who are started on one triplet, eventually when that fails, will move on to the next and the next. And so it's only a matter of which sequence you use these four triplets, not a question of, you know, which of them you'll use and which of them you'd not use. It's only the sequence that will vary, but you will end up using all of these triplets.
So I want to ask you to kind of put together a couple of clinical scenarios where you would use ixazomib and elotuzumab. And before you go into that, just a word, because I guess another option that we haven't mentioned and doesn't seem to be generating as much excitement, but yet it was a newly approved drug in this last year, which is panobinostat in combination with bortezomib. Where are we today with this strategy? Is it being looked at in any further trials? Do you use it in your practice?
I do. I have actually written up a case of a patient who had failed just everything and was salvaged with pantobinostat. So you don't want to dump drugs that are actually quite effective. Pantobinostat also has the same problem as ELO, which is a skepticism among experts about whether it works or not, primarily because it didn't work as a single agent. But it did show significant prolongation of PFS when you combine it with bortezomib compared to bortezomib alone. The main problem was that the schedule was wrong. At the dose it was given and at the schedule of bortezomib it was mixed with, there was a high incidence of grade 3 neuropathy and a high incidence of grade 3 diarrhea, which scared people off. So the company is doing trials with better schedules, and I expect if you use it in combination with once weekly bortezomib subcutaneous and escalate the dose more gradually, we start with 10 and then build it up to 20, you're going to see much less problems. And I would like people to use pantobinostat as a way of overcoming proteasome inhibitor resistance. And in that regard, I would also mix it with carfilzomib if proteasome inhibitor resistance is one that you're worried about or you're wanting to tackle. So yes, I mean, there is a role for pantobinostat as well. Again, many myeloma patients can live through multiple triplets and then you're still having a relapse and you're wondering what to do next. It's worthwhile considering pantobinostat at some point as an addition to an existing proteasome inhibitor-based backbone.
Let's cone down on two of the other approved drugs that we wanted to talk about. And I asked you to put together a scenario of a patient who you might use elotuzumab with lenalidomide, and you came up with a 75-year-old patient. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, for the elderly patient with newly diagnosed myeloma, the two approaches are, one is to follow the first trial, which used Lendex alone and treat to progression. We know what you can get with that. So at 2.5-3 years, patients will progress. At that point, you know, what do you do? The other scenario that is even more frequent is patients take Lendex and then they stop therapy. They've done well, but they stop therapy because they're doing well and they want a break from treatment. And in that scenario, when they relapse, you think that they are still Len sensitive. Now, both these scenarios, you know, you could prolong how long Len works by adding elotuzumab with minimal additional toxicity. And so I would say that in a first relapse in an elderly patient who is known to be Len sensitive, RD ELO would be a very easy option, and you would prolong how long the Lendex worked in such a situation. Again, the other competitor for a similar patient would be ixazomib, which is offering the convenience of oral therapy, although probably with a little bit more side effects.
You put together another scenario that I'd like you to sort of dissect out a little bit with a 69-year-old patient.
Yes, absolutely. So the 69-year-old patient had 414 myeloma, and 414 myeloma of all the other subtypes particularly responds well to proteasome inhibitor. So we want to use a proteasome inhibitor as much as possible. The patient did get a CyBorD induction for 4 cycles, got a transplant, but progressed fairly quickly and then was treated with carfilzomib Lendex, again to keep the proteasome inhibitor backbone treatment going, but was unable to tolerate it. And partly from the frequent infusion reactions and partly from they get shortness of breath with the infusion, and it was very hard to manage this patient. But I still wanted to give a proteasome inhibitor. And since the patient had not done well on bortezomib before and had progressed on carfilzomib, I felt like, you know, the best option for this patient would be to give ixazomib. And that's what we did. So ixazomib is a great drug to consider when you have patients with multiple comorbidities who are unable to tolerate or get parenteral therapy with a proteasome inhibitor.
Let's finish out talking about Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia. And I saw you had a paper in Blood Cancer Journal in February kind of providing an overview of it. Where are we today with Waldenstrom's and where are things heading?
So Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia is a relatively rare plasma cell, lymphoplasma cell disorder. The most important identifying characteristic is the presence of an IgM immunoglobulin and lymphoplasmacytic clonal cells in the bone marrow. Just like with myeloma, there is an IgM MGUS phase, there is a smoldering Waldenstrom's phase, and then there are the patients with the symptomatic Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia. What we have learned recently is that almost all of these patients, or most of them, carry a mutation of MYD88 that can be used now to identify these patients. We also have learned that so far, the initial treatments we have used, which is either R-bendamustine or dexamethasone, rituximab, or dexamethasone, cyclophosphamide, rituximab combinations. But what we have learned recently is that ibrutinib is highly active, and it works in the vast majority of patients and with very durable responses. And so people are now moving ibrutinib to earlier in the disease course, even into the frontline setting. So we have an array of options for treatment of Waldenstrom's. Ibrutinib is the most promising of these options, but there's also really good treatments like rituximab, bendamustine, or rituximab, cyclodex, or rituximab, bortezomib dex that can be used for these patients as well.
In what clinical situations right now outside a trial setting are you using ibrutinib?
In my practice, which is purely plasma cell disorders, it's mainly Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia.
But I mean, what kind of clinical situation in Waldenstrom's?
First relapse. We have still not embraced the newly diagnosed, mainly because of the lack of data, but the data is coming out very soon, so we'll probably switch as well. But right now, first relapse.